Welcome to the HIV Australia podcast, a discussion about the community-led response to HIV. In this episode, Dr. Skye McGregor and Robert Monaghan from the Kirby Institute talk about the most recent epidemiological HIV and sexual health data for Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples and some of its implications for consideration.
Well, thanks everyone for coming on board today. And before we do start our presentation today, I'd just like to acknowledge the traditional custodians of the land on each and every point that we dial into from today and that you're seated on. It's Aboriginal land. I'd also like to pay my respects to our elders in those areas and our emerging leaders in those regions as well. So my name's Rob Monaghan. I'm the manager of Aboriginal Health Research at the Kirby Institute at University of New South Wales. And it's a pleasure to be here. And I might let Skye introduce herself.
Thanks, Rob. I'm joining you from Bidjigal land today. I'm Skye McGregor, an epidemiologist at the Kirby Institute, and work closely with Rob and an amazing team here on surveillance of sexually transmissible infections and bloodborne viruses in Australia. So today, Rob, we're just going to have a chat about the latest data that the Kirby Institute has pulled together on rates of STIs and BBVs among Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples in Australia. And I thought we could kick off by talking about some of the areas in Australia we have seen progress in recent years. And I think genital warts and HPV vaccination has been a really great success story in Australia. And as you know, what we've seen in particularly young people is a substantial decline in new diagnoses of genital warts. So in young Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander women, age less than 21 years, we've seen a decline from 5% in 2006, so pre-vaccine, to 0% in 2021, which is pretty amazing. And in young men, new diagnoses of genital warts have declined from 3.7% in 2006 to 0.7% in 2021. So Rob, what are your thoughts on this success story in Australia and what do we need to do to maintain this success?
Well, I think the success here, Skye, is, you know, obviously the vaccine rates, introduction into schools and more research, more emphasis on this. So I think that's had a huge impact in what we see now, more education, but the vaccine rates are probably, you know, a lot better in this here. So, yeah, and look, more, I think we're getting, you know, more, what could you say, more health promotions out there as well. It's an area that we need more of, more education in our younger generation. But obviously things like, you know, genital warts is starting to, we can see the, you know, the positive what comes out of the vaccine rates for this. So, yeah, I think it's good. It's really enlightening, but we, you know, just can't dismiss the hard work that's been done previously, but there's still a lot of hard work to be done in this area as well.
Thanks, Rob. And if we move on to HIV next, we've seen across Australia a huge success in the reduction of notification of HIV among certain groups. So among gay and bisexual men born in Australia in particular, we've seen a decline. And in recent years, we've seen quite a decline of HIV notifications reported as Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander. So we saw a peak of notifications in 2016 with 47 new cases. In the last 2 years, there's been 17, so a decrease of 64% since that 2016 peak. How much do you think COVID's impacted on that, Rob? And what do you think we need to do to ensure that those numbers do stay low for Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people?
For me, Skye, I think COVID's going to have a huge impact. Now, we probably won't even know what the impact COVID's had for maybe a little while, simply because there's going to be a lag period, I presume. But look, some of this is really good. You know, the old days when we had the Grim Reaper ads and everyone still remembers those. And we need another, you know, for me, I think we need more campaigns, probably not as, not as violent as the Grim Reaper one was, but we still need that, you know, health literacy in our Aboriginal communities. And when I say health literacy, it needs to be at a level that is user-friendly, everyone can understand. And I think HIV notifications obviously has a high importance in our Aboriginal communities around this. But again, I think there's lots of education, lots of work, And obviously COVID's had a, you know, some sort of impact. And like I said, I don't think we're going to know what the real impact of COVID is going to be until a few, maybe 12 months, maybe 2 years down the track, especially in things like this. And we know, you know, especially the education around that men have sex with men, that's a huge area that we need to put more emphasis on in our communities. And obviously there's different STR rates to HIV and Hep C rates are different from, you know, metropolitan to remote. But I think we still need, you know, not to take our mind away from this, because it's going to be an ongoing issue for a long, long period of time.
Thanks, Robin. I think it's a really key point you make throughout of we need to ensure we maintain our focus on these things. Just because we've seen some success doesn't mean we can withdraw efforts. We need to sustain those efforts as well as enhancing it in other areas, just like you said.
Yeah. And look, just to add, Sky, you know, I think the population we deal with Aboriginal communities, because they're such a, you know, culturally they're you know, a caring and sharing community. They're a condensed community because they're always around each other. So there's real, you know, there's a real skepticism here on things will get out of control really easily if we don't, you know, pay like a lot of attention to the good work that's been done, but there's still a lot of work to be done to maintain a low rate like it is.
And I think often you highlight the importance of co-design too in some of those strategies, Robin. You know, how you've talked about public health campaigns. It sounds like that's a real place for working with communities, like you said, to come up with something that's going to be effective public health messaging in that context.
Exactly right, Spy. You know, look, we all work in the, you know, the sexual health, the health industry, but, you know, we don't know everything and we don't know our target populations to a point where we can design and implement strategies to, let's say, target men who have sex with men. You know, we need men, we need that population around a table to be asking them the question of how do we do this? How do we implement it? How do we get great success? That's what we need to be doing. You know, we have really smart people in our, you know, research industry, in our health sector, but we need the people, our target populations, at the table with us when we design programs and strategies that affect them.
Thanks, Rob. The other infection that's we have a universal vaccination program for is hepatitis B. And we know that there's been very high coverage of hepatitis B vaccination in both Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander and non-Indigenous populations. The 12-month vaccination is lower for Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander infants at 92%, but then exceeds the non-Indigenous population at 24 months with 97% of the population vaccinated. Does that suggest issues around timeliness of vaccination, Rob, or what other reason do you think there might be for the gap in that 12-month versus 24-month vaccination coverage?
Yeah, look, traditionally, when you think about Aboriginal people, like traditionally they've been really good. Vaccination coverage, you know, from childhood right through to adults has been excellent. But in this area here, you see that 12-month period, there's been that slight dip, you know, that we see now, which is concerning. But, you know, It'd be good to see, like, look, some of the dips might be, you know, access to services in a 12-month period, access to culturally appropriate services, remote areas, whole raft of issues, I think. But the good thing is across that 24-month period, you know, it is exceeding the wider population standard. So that is one good thing, but we do need to do more work in that 12-month period to get it to a point where we're at the same point as the wider population as well.
Thanks, Robin. Alongside the vaccination, we do see much lower rates of hepatitis B notifications. And so there was only 156 notifications of hepatitis B among Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people in 2021, which is 3% of notifications, which is roughly what we would expect in terms of the proportion of the overall population. Quite different. So obviously we're starting to see some success and declines in rates over 10 years if you look at it for hepatitis B. So I think, again, highlights the importance of vaccination, maintaining high coverage.
Yeah. And look, what I suppose for Hep B is concerning is around what it leads on to into chronic disease. You know, that's the end point. If we don't get onto this really quickly and monitor it over a long period of time, because it can have, you know, huge health implications for our Aboriginal communities. And we've seen that in our communities. And, you know, in Australia in 2023, these things, you know, should not be happening really. But to have rates like Hep B, where there's a vaccination rate 2 times higher than the wider population, you know, we're doing well, but we need to do better.
There's some areas we've seen limited or no progress, unfortunately, in the last few years, and that particularly relates to sexually transmissible infections. So for chlamydia, we see rates 3 times higher among the Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander population, 5 times higher for gonorrhea, and 5.5 times for infectious syphilis. What are your thoughts on this, Rob, and what do we really need to be doing now across those three infections?
Well, this has a difference in, I suppose, in location and geographical location. So there's a huge difference there. We need to be doing, and you brought up co-design earlier, we need to be doing that better with our Aboriginal communities. So we need to be going to them and asking them, you know, what is going to work in their communities? Like we have we have all the strategies, we have all the resources, but what we're doing at the moment is just not working. So we need to be going to community and saying, why would you go and see a doctor? What would make you go and see a doctor to have a chlamydia test or a PCR test? Why would you go somewhere to get screened? So we need to know that from communities so we can implement strategies that, you know, gets them to an institution whether that's a service, a health service, and they have a screening. Because obviously screening at the moment is not working. Because, you know, to have, especially chlamydia, which is dead easy to, you know, identify and, medicate, 3 times higher. That's just shouldn't be happening. So we need to have better strategies there. One of the things here on some of this data is, you know, the missing status as well. So that is one thing that we need to know. We know approximately, you know, let's just say a bit over 50% go to an Aboriginal community-controlled health service, which is great. We know community-controlled health services are, you know, the best way of accessing Aboriginal communities. But what we want to know is where is everyone else going? Are they going to other places if they identify as an Aboriginal person? So that's one thing that probably, you know, down the track we need to do better in. But yeah, rates, I think we need to come up with innovative ways of screening Aboriginal people. And this is just not saying that we need to mass screen Aboriginal people. This is saying, you know, how do we entice Aboriginal people with their own, under their own permission and under their own enthusiasm to come and get tested, to make it, you know, appealing enough for them to get tested.
And rates are particularly high, we know, among young people, you know, in that 15 to 29 year age group, and probably not the group who are used to engaging with a bunch of, dare I say, boring old researchers about the best way to do this. So this is potentially a new approach, and I think it's going to take time, isn't it, and understanding, and there needs to be patience and acceptance that this isn't going to happen overnight, but to have a robust approach to it really requires some long-term engagement, doesn't it?
Oh, you know, and I think when we, when we see funders and we see, grants get put out, you know, they only get put out for a certain length of time, 2 to 3 years. What we need to be saying to funders that, you know, it takes time to get into Aboriginal communities to earn trust, build relationships. So it takes time to implement a program. And again, like you just said, it's you know, not that we're boring researchers, but we're researchers that implement something and we want an outcome. But for Aboriginal people, it's about, you know, okay, how is this going to work in our community? Why would I go and see, or why would I go and sit down with a researcher to get tested, one, and then to, you know, fill out a survey form? So we need to be making that more accessible, but also making it more fun for people to get tested. You know, one of the biggest stress points in your life is you're going to go and see a doctor. So what we need to be saying to our communities is, what would make you go to see a doctor and it's not a stress point? You know, to make this built into your everyday routine, you know, whether that's 6 monthly, whether that's 12 monthly. And I know, you know, the Aboriginal Community Control, they have a this adult health check, which is every 12 months. You know, it could be something that we do around that, build that into having an SDI check. So a comprehensive health check for our Aboriginal communities.
Yeah.
And we need to think about how do we have, you know, interventions, so opportunistic interventions into our patients that when they do come in, we use every opportunity to ask them about their, you know, at-risk behaviours, if they have any, because that's the point, you know. That age bracket that you're talking about, Sky, is you know, the one that we have the highest rates in, and we know they don't go to doctors and they don't go to health services. So the challenge for us is how do we get them into services and how do we get them tested, but how do we keep them there long term? That's the challenge for us as researchers. And we're doing that with some of our programs with, you know, innovative ways of enticing Aboriginal people to come and have a test, but also taking the stigma out of sexual health around other, you know, having that holistic view on it. You know, we could be talking about mental health. We could be talking about other issues that also relate to Aboriginal people.
Yeah, so it sounds like it's just about normalising it. It's just part of, you say, holistic approach. Sexual health and STI testing is just part of everyday life. And when you talk about that young group and the implications of not being tested and treated, obviously there's significant impacts on reproductive health potentially. And if we look specifically at infectious syphilis, we know that we've seen very high rates of congenital syphilis, unfortunately, across Australia, but particularly among Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander infants. We focus very much on women getting tested and that it's about women getting tested to stop transmission. Do you think exactly what you've said about making it holistic, it's more about integrating relationships in general and the whole community into that idea of testing?
Yeah, and you touched on a really good one, because, you know, we see a lot of, especially some of the rates here, higher in women and some are higher in men, but, you know, at the end of the day, they both have sex at some point. So we need to be able, you know, instead of just targeting one gender, we need to be able to target almost like a targeting a community, especially when you're thinking about congenital syphilis. You know, it has that ripple effect right through the whole community, because, you know, it could have devastating effects on, you know, stillborn families and extended families throughout the whole community. So I think there's a whole, you know, emphasis on how we do this, how we educate the whole community about this, not just target individuals or genders, but we need to be thinking or looking at it as a family unit or as a whole community unit, and coming up with programs that, you know, has that multiple effect on our Aboriginal community. So you're not only dealing with the, you know, whatever disease we're talking about, but you're also educating them in those communities, and you're educating people from, you know, the 16-year-olds right up to the, let's say, the 60 or the 70-year-olds, because there's that whole facing community, especially Aboriginal communities, there's this whole emphasis on, you know, knowledge transfer right across the whole age bracket. So we need to be able to, you know, have that conversation with everyone in our community, because they all have a, you know, a responsibility to keep their communities healthy. And that's, again, that whole philosophy around caring and sharing holistic views in our Aboriginal communities, but also sitting down with our community members and saying, you know, what is going to work? Because what we do in our Aboriginal communities up to date is, you know, we do to, we don't do with. So we need to be able to doing our research, our implement our health programs with our Aboriginal communities.
Thanks, Robin. I think you raise the important point too there, and in those discussions, that it's about removing that stigma around sexual health, and as you say, having it so that every age group is comfortable discussing it with their sexual partners and within community in appropriate settings, and having a clinician that they're comfortable going to, whether it's in GP setting or Aboriginal community controlled setting, is having situations of trust that you can have those discussions around sexual health.
And, you know, just off the top of my head, just thinking about how what the role the education department would play in this as well, because I think their PDHP, whatever program they have in their schools, you know, ask the question, is it going far enough? Is it going to a point where they're having, you know, meaningful dialogue with young kids around this? Because we look at the 16 to 29, that's the legal age, but I could probably guarantee you they're probably, you know, we know our young kids these days are sexually active at a younger age. So we, those conversations need to start somewhere. And I think the education department, you know, bear in mind that it needs to be done, you know, appropriately. They need to start in that area as well. They need to start those conversations. And then, you know, services outside of that can then carry those conversations on. But I do think there's a whole point. And this data shows that, you know, that age bracket, they're at the one of the at most risk. So we need to be doing more, I think, right from the conversation starter. And they might not be sexually active, but highly likely they would be, to a point where, you know, services such as researchers, such as health services, carry the conversations on.
I think,
I'm probably gabbling on here a bit.
No, I was just thinking it's really, it's, you know, we have evidence from the Australian Secondary School Survey that there's been interruptions to sexual health education. And you can imagine that's across the board. That's not restricted to inner city settings. That's everywhere. And I think if we know already that the rates are so high, particularly among Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander kids in that 16 plus age group, we know that the rates are far higher in remote settings, up to 77 times higher for some infections, that I think, as you say, education plays a critical role. If we know COVID has interrupted that, now is the time to be proactive about it and getting in there, working with kids to have those conversations. Just finally, Rob, hepatitis C is the last infection we look at in that report. And what we're seeing is consistently for the last 5 years, the rates among Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples have been around seven times higher than the non-Indigenous population. Slightly different to what we see with other infections, the rates are actually higher in major cities and regional areas than in remote settings. What do you think some of the disparity is about, and what do you think we can be doing in relation to hepatitis C among Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples?
Yeah. Well, it's interesting, isn't it? You know, it's a complete opposite to STIs. But when you think about how the access to, you know, lots of things here, it's about access in this major, and it's about access to services, it's about access to injecting drug, you know, paraphernalia. So all those things have a huge impact on in the major cities because they're readily available, more so than in remote areas. So I just think that we're probably having a look at where the most risk is, and the most risk is probably where they have most access to injecting drug equipment. And when we think about, you know, and this is probably a controversial one, our prison systems, we have, you know, major prisons in major cities that probably high rates of incarceration of Aboriginal people. But yeah, this is I think there was a report James Ward brought out that this could potentially be catastrophic in our Aboriginal communities if left unchecked. And we know, you know, lots of our, especially our Aboriginal communities, gravitate towards major cities at some point in their lives for different reasons. But regional and major cities are a major concern. But again, it's about how do we, you know, if these are in their major cities and in our regional areas, how do we entice or how do we educate people? How do we get, you know, resources to Aboriginal community control services that play a huge part, you know, and it might be about the needle and syringe exchange program. Does that need to be looked at in a different way with our Aboriginal communities? So I think there's a huge, huge period we're going to go through. And look, and this is a good example on, you know, the impact of COVID. What are these numbers going to look like in 12 months to 2 years because of COVID? You know, they might not have been able to get out to get clean injecting equipment. So notifications, I think, could potentially be higher, maybe, or not, you know. But I think COVID's going to have this, and HIV could be ever, we might see an impact over the next 12 months to 2 years.
Yeah, and in relation to hepatitis C, obviously access to highly effective treatment is crucial too. And I think, as you say, now is the time to be ensuring that people who need it can access treatment easily.
Yeah, and, you know, access treatment, but finish treatment. So start treatment, initiate treatment, but a lot of our community members are not actually going through the whole regime of finishing the treatment. And that's, you know, obviously also in our custodial settings. What does that look like? So there's a whole raft of questions that need to be asked on how we could do things better. And, you know, someone that's got a diagnosis, Hep C diagnosis, and goes on treatment, it's a huge change in their lives. And when you think about, you know, anything with Aboriginal people, it's also those social determinants that surround them when they've got a diagnosis, you know, stable living environments, poverty, and especially living in these major cities, you know, it's very expensive to live in major cities. So all these social determinants that are around our Aboriginal communities, you know, should be taken into account as well when our communities have a diagnosis.
Thanks, Rob. I think, you know, from all of these discussions, it's clear it's complex. We've seen substantial gains in some areas and less in other areas. But I think it's a very important point you make about the social determinants. I think we tend to focus on we just need to get everyone treated or we just need to get everyone tested, when in actual fact, this is part of people's complex lives, which is an interplay of many, many factors and many of those things you've noted. So what's your take-home message from the data we see and what you would want to see from here?
Obviously, you know, what we need here is as researchers or as health practitioners that, you know, have a service responsibility to Aboriginal communities, you know, the biggest thing I want to see is we sit down with Aboriginal people and ask them what they want and how they would want programs implemented in their communities, give them ownership of programs. And, you know, we come up with these buzzwords about co-design, but, you know, you can't underestimate the power of sitting down with someone, getting their input and getting their ownership of the program, and then seeing the end result of, you know, success. I'm positive we could, you know, have better outcomes if we co-design our programs, our strategies in a more culturally sensitive manner with our communities. That's one thing. And I think, you know, as researchers, as, you know, I think we need more leadership in Aboriginal people leading, you know, research into Aboriginal communities more. We need more funding. Obviously, we need more funding to do this. It's a really vicious circle in, you know, to make improvement or get results, you need funding to implement research. But you can't do research and you can't implement research if you don't have the funding. So governments need to come on board and say, if we need evidence, we need to be able to do the, you know, research. So we need more funding. It's just simple as that. But, and, you know, I think we've gone right away from in the health sector around health promotion. We don't seem to worry about health promotion. We just deal with the disease when it comes up. So we need more health promotion in our communities, but in a more innovative way of doing it, you know, not just printing up flyers and hanging them on the, you know, community hall. We need more innovative ways of coming up with programs and health promotion. You know, and we need a workforce. You know, we always talk about a workforce in our communities. We don't really have a workforce that could implement. Like, we as researchers can go in and implement strategies and programs for research purposes, come up with results. But then the ongoing, you know, what is the end goal? We need people in those communities to implement on an ongoing basis around the strategies or the interventions that we've come up with. So there's a whole raft of things. I think there's not just one thing that you can say, look, this is going to cure hepatitis C in our Aboriginal communities, or, you know, bring the numbers down. There's got to be a whole multi-pronged attack on multiple diseases in our communities. And it's ongoing, but I think the biggest secret is, you know, for me, is to get Aboriginal people involved in it right from the get-go. And even before we put our funding agreements in and our funding applications We need to be able to say to Aboriginal people, what is going to work in your community? Because clearly, you know, I don't live in a remote area and lots of people don't live in remote areas, but we do a lot of our work in remote areas. So we need to be able to say to people, look, what is going to work? Is it, you know, do we rock up to the basketball game on a Friday night and, you know, we put on a sausage sandwich and we do PCR tests? We don't know that until we ask the Aboriginal community. So we need to be able to have that trust, you know, relationships, but it takes time. So, yeah, I'll probably pack a lot into that and probably cost it out at over $1 million. But, you know, that's some of the things we might need in our Aboriginal communities to start with.
Thanks, Rob. It's been fantastic hearing your insights into the latest SDI and BBV data for Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples. And I think it's clear that the answer isn't sitting in a office in a city, but it's getting out there and asking Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people what they think will work.
Yeah. Yeah. And for sure. And Skye, you know, I think for yourself and your team, I think there's, you know, the Aboriginal Surveillance Report is a, you know, it's a godsend for researchers and health departments about, you know, okay, what is the real rate? Because honestly, a lot of people wouldn't even know what the rates are in communities that they even work in.
Well, thank you so much for your time, Rob. And yeah, look forward to continuing the work we do together.
Yeah, no worries. Thank you, Skye.